This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm with Dr. Daniel Mortlock from Imperial College London. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Indy. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for being on our show. So to start things off, could you just give us in a few words what your research is about?
I'm what's called an astrostatistician, which is a word that didn't exist until a few years ago. Which is someone who sort of straddles the world of astronomy and mathematics, and I do a lot of data analysis and trying to get the most out of the data that astronomers get from the big telescopes around the world.
Okay, that's really interesting. So were you initially trained more as a mathematician or as an astronomer?
No, I was trained, I did a physics degree as an undergrad because I, in about second year, ran into a wall when it came to some of the more complex mathematical topics, and so had to curtail that. And it's kind of a bit weird now that my position at Imperial is half in the mathematics department and half in the physics department, and I teach a lot of statistics, having never done a statistics course. So my training was all physics, and the statistics was learned on the job, as it were, actually trying to do research and solve practical problems.
So I'm guessing with the advent of new modern telescopes, which produce absolutely huge amounts of data, that's where the statistics really comes in useful.
That's right. So one of the key changes is that, you know, 100 years ago, the idea was that you'd have an astronomer, you know, maybe even looking through the eyepiece of a telescope, looking at the object they were interested in, you know, drawing pictures of it or eventually taking photographs of it. And, you know, over the last few decades, there's been this change that now these telescopes take huge surveys of the sky where they're not looking at any one particular object. They're trying to get a representative picture of some aspect of the universe. And that means that what the astronomer gets at the end, the researcher gets, is a huge database of all these objects with their positions and how bright they are and other properties. And this starts to become more like a data mining problem and less like a traditional astronomy problem. So that's why there's this, you know, huge motivation for applying statistical techniques to try and, in my case in particular, find the rarest objects, the unusual things in these huge data sets.
I was going to ask you for a sort of example of what you can do with statistics in astronomy and why it's useful to use these techniques.
So one thing that I'll be talking about today in my seminar in a couple of hours at Manchester is hunting through a big survey done at infrared wavelengths, so just, you know, longer wavelengths, redder than the human eye can see, the sort of thing that you've seen in movies through night vision goggles. And what we're doing with this survey called UKIDS is, amongst other things, looking for the most distant quasars that we can see, objects that you see a very red color because of, largely because of the expansion of the universe stretching out the light. These objects are very rare. In maybe a catalogue of 100 million objects, there might be 10 of the target things that we're looking for. So they're very rare. It's real sort of needle in a haystack stuff. And it turns out that if you just look through the data and try and find things that have sort of the appearance of what you're looking for, you might find your 10 objects, but you're dominated by thousands and thousands of things that look red, but aren't really because of the fact that the data is imperfect. So then it's a case of applying statistics to try and separate out the things that, you know, look like what you're looking for by coincidence versus the things that really are like that. And so that's one of the projects that we've been working on.
Your role as an astronomer, do you usually work on data sets that have already been collected and that, you know, already out there in public, or do you collaborate closely with observers and set up observations where you know that your statistical expertise is going to come in handy?
More the former. More it's the sort of thing where these big surveys are happening, you know, the momentum behind them is already there and you know that this huge data set is going to come. Certainly I try and get involved in the data quite closely because to really understand what's going on, you've actually got to get involved. It's much harder to just sit there and download a huge file from some server and then get going on it because, you know, it's very complex. It's not that simple. But in spirit, yeah, the main thing is that this data is already available and it's a case of sifting through because the night sky is a very rich place. And even though maybe tens or hundreds of astronomers have looked at the data and done the science they want to do with it, there's usually more things that can be done just because of the nature of the universe we live in.
So you can get maybe new information or interesting insights out of data that's previously been published and people think, oh, well, we've done all we can with that, and you can sort of cover it.
Absolutely. I mean, an example of this, it's not research that I've done, but one of the things that I've seen done a few times now is where people go back and look at almost the oldest astronomy data we have, where people were using glass plates to take images from telescopes maybe 100 years ago.
Wow.
And obviously they couldn't see the faint things that you see with the Hubble or anything like that. But so you're only looking at the brightest stars. But it turns out that this is really important because the brightest stars are sufficiently close to Earth that they actually move across the sky very slowly. And that means that you can try and measure that motion using modern telescopes, but the trouble is that in the couple of years that you might be doing a survey, they haven't gone very far. Whereas if you can find these objects on these old plates, because of the baseline, the fact you've got a century of motion in there, even though the data aren't so good, it's actually the best way to measure how they're moving. Mm. So people have been systematically going through and doing this, and, you know, as a result, have discovered some exciting things.
Do you have a favourite wavelength? Or do you work more in the optical or the infrared or radio or any of the above as long as there's enough data?
Yeah, it's really any of the above as long as there's enough data. It's one of the fun things about being at least in part a statistician is that you can sort of scan around and look for interesting problems, not just in any areas of astronomy, but more broadly as well. And so in astronomy, the fact that, you know, I was using this infrared data to look for these distant quasars was a case of, I suppose, form follows function. It's, you know, this was the wavelength where we'd see these objects distinguished from other astronomical sources, and so that's why I worked with that data. The actual wavelength at which the data comes in is, it's almost an irrelevance in terms of the analysis, or it can often be.
And what are some new problems or areas that are facing astronomy and astrophysics that could possibly be solved using a statistical approach more than the standard astronomy techniques?
So, there's a couple of things like this, and an example that I think is really exciting is a new telescope that's not yet been built, but will be by the US, called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, or LSST, as it's generically known, just the acronym. It will be one of the larger telescopes in the world with an 8-meter mirror, but unlike the other big telescopes like that, which are used for making very detailed observations of particular objects, this one will be equipped with the optics such that it can do big surveys of the sky for looking at much fainter sources than the current survey telescopes do. And then not just that, it won't just make surveys of the sky that are very deep, it'll also do this repeatedly so that you get a sort of dynamical picture of the sky and you see variable stars and supernovae and moving objects and things like this. And so in terms of the data it'll produce, it'll reveal all sorts of things that we haven't seen before. But only if we can actually process this data sensibly, because the volumes will be sort of orders of magnitude, factors of 100 or 1,000 bigger than any current surveys. And it's pretty clear that the current techniques for analyzing this data won't work, that we'll need to supplement this with techniques from machine learning and computer science and statistics as well. So, mm-hmm. So this project, I think, is an example of the sort of thing where astronomy is really becoming a data science, and it's not my favorite buzz phrase, but it's definitely a case of big data.
Actually, speaking of computers, in your day-to-day work, do you need to use, you know, supercomputers or very powerful computers to process all the data, or is it still relatively simple to the extent that you can process it on something that's accessible to the average person?
So in terms of taking the data from the surveys that I've been working with, like UKIDS and the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the SDSS, another survey I use, the people who run these surveys and take the data and produce the catalogues, they do that using large computers, and that's a very sort of serious endeavour. But in terms of what I myself do, in terms of trying to find the objects we're looking for and so forth, I think it's true that I've done almost all, or maybe even all of that, on my 4-year-old MacBook Pro. For me, at least, I'm not one of these people who gets into sort of big algorithms and speeding up computer programs and so forth, partly because I'm not very good at it. Whereas what does interest me is sort of new ways of looking at the data, and actually a lot of the time you can, you know, find some techniques which don't require huge computational effort. So I imagine, you know, lots of people listening to this have got a Mac laptop or, something similar. You know, it's nothing special in terms of computing.
Okay, that's really interesting. And going back to the search for the quasars, how many in the end did you find? How many needles in the proverbial haystack showed up?
So in the end, we found 14 needles in that haystack, and 6 or 7 of those were these distant quasars that had already been seen before in other surveys, which was a good test because we wanted to make sure that we were finding the things that we knew were already in that area. But the really exciting thing was that we found what was and remains, at least currently of the date of this interview, the most distant one of these bright quasars ever found, which was something that we were incredibly excited about. And the reason for this is that, I suppose, comes back to the finite speed of light, that the more distant an object you see in the universe, the longer the light's been travelling from it, and you're seeing it as it was when the universe was that little bit younger. And so for this quasar, we see it as the universe was when it was about 800 million years old, which is only 5% of its current age of about 13.8 billion years. And, it's only 100 million years younger than the previous record holder. But it turns out this is a very exciting time in the history of the universe. It's when all the hydrogen gas that was making galaxies and between galaxies was getting split into electrons and protons by the first generations of stars lighting up. And it turns out that these bright quasars are one of the best ways to see what's going on there. They act as a kind of lighthouse shining through everything between us and them. This is the sort of astronomy payoff of doing all this statistics, of finding this, so far unique source. And there's probably only maybe 100 sources over the whole sky that are as bright and as distant as this.
Wow.
So that's the sort of the payoff of doing all this.
Oh, that's fantastic news. Well, there's a bright future ahead, excuse the pun, for astrophysics, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks very much for talking to us, Daniel.
Absolute pleasure.